Counsel.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Charles Jenkins for the appellant. Your Honors, I have just a few precatory remarks before I intend to address the Mitchell factors directly. The case of Regents v. John Doe at 519 U.S. 425 is particularly instructive, I think, here. There, the U.S. Supreme Court applied the Mitchell factors in answering the question of whether a state university acted as an arm of the state in managing Lawrence Livermore Laboratories. The case is instructive for 2 points. First of all, it's very clear that in conducting this examination, the examination between the relationship between the appellant and the state, it's very important that although it be recognized as a federal question, a question that will be decided by this court, the court's viewpoint must be from the state's point of view. It has to embrace the state's recognition of the entity
and
how the entity operates.
There's obviously no comparison that's worth very much between the University of California and your client.
Oh, agreed.
And the University of California is created by the state. Everybody who it is the governance is appointed by the state, by the governor and by other members of the state government. It is funded by the state. And the issue there was a very discreet one, which was, as I recall, that bill in question or the money in question was ultimately going to come from the federal government, although it was there was initial liability in the state. But there was no question as to the entity being a state-created, run, and governed entity.
Your Honor, I've gotten us off on the wrong foot. I referenced the case because of the approach to the examination. Clearly, they ruled there was no 11th Amendment immunity there. And the second point I wanted to make was that they weighed the Mitchell factors in a very dynamic way. They talked about a close call. The first factor and the second factor largely weighed against each other, and that court went on to look at the other factors, and they pointed against 11th Amendment immunity. My point to you was that they started out from looking at it from the way the state defines the entity, the way the state promulgated the underlying
statute. I think you're wrong about that, too. Wasn't the conclusion that there was 11th Amendment immunity?
Was not.
No, I thought there was.
I believe they came to the conclusion that the remaining factors, because number one and number two were evenly weighted, I thought that the remaining factors went the other way. But my only point was that it is not a formulaic approach. And then finally, if the factors point in different directions, as they often do, it's important to keep in mind the goals of the 11th Amendment to protect.
Right, well, just for your information, they held that that there was 11th Amendment immunity in that case.
Okay, so. Very good. The factors here, let's spend our time where they should be spent. I'm going to go in reverse order, if that's all right. The fifth factor, the corporate status of the entity. Well, clearly the appellant is a corporation. It exists independent of the state. That factor mitigates against 11th Amendment immunity.
Is there any case which has even applied the Mitchell factors to a completely private corporation, which can't be an arm of the state of California on a completely commonsensical ground because it operates all over the country and not only in California, and in which the state of California has no role in its governance as an entity, whatever?
Oh, well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with your perspective on the entity. The entity works solely to discharge the prosecutorial duties of the district attorney.
And it doesn't also work in New York, Ohio, Texas, and Mississippi. I mean, just I don't
sure,
know which state.
Sure,
large number of other states to do similar things, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And does California have anything to do with choosing its directors, running its finances, or anything at all to do with its creation or governance?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
The entity is private, but it works in very very.
Do you have any cases in which state sovereign immunity has been held to apply to an entity of that type, no matter what it's doing?
Well, if I understand your question correctly, I am aware of a case, I believe.
Other than that one district court case on this issue, other than that?
Well, there's.
No, on the 11th Amendment case. There was
The Anderson case, and, Your Honor, I can get that cite for
but
you.
But does it strike you that after 200 and whatever years that there's one case in the world, that there's maybe something wrong with this notion?
Well, no, Your Honor, if you come at it from a certain perspective, I think you can conclude it's a wrongful notion. But I assure you that in this case, we have to look at the relationship between the entity and the state. And it's pretty clear here that this entity is controlled very, very tightly by the legislation.
It's not controlled at all as an entity by the state, right? Does the state tell you, does the state have anything to do with choosing the directors, choosing the staff, running the finances, or anything to do with the governance of this entity?
I don't believe that's the test, Your Honor. It isn't the internal workings of the appellant.
It isn't? Why not?
Well, because it's the relationship between the entity and the state function that's being exercised is where the examination should be, not what happens inside the appellant's own operation. Now, in this case, the fourth factor is important here, and I think we can begin to make some progress here. The fourth factor is whether the entity has power to take property in its own name or only in the name of the state. This speaks to your concern, Your Honor. This entity cannot take property in its own name. In connection with bad check diversion, it runs the back house.
Doesn't this entity have leases in its own name? Doesn't it have computers and office space and so on in its own name? Does it have anything? Does state have anything to do with that?
I understand your point. I think when you look at this factor, it's very clear that a private company can go out and sign a lease or acquire a computer, but that does not offer us any insight on its relationship with the state. I would suggest that that factor has to be examined in connection with the behaviors that are the subject of the inquiry. In connection with bad check diversion, the entity works at the pleasure of the district attorney. It's only the district attorney that can go out and collect restitutionary funds or insist that people sit for an educational class. It's only the district attorney that can engage in any of these behaviors. So the appellant is only performing under the auspices of the district attorney's authority.
So would your theory apply to every privatizing, subcontracting?
No, not at all, Your Honor.
Why not?
Very unusual situation here. Thank you for asking. This is, in my reading of the case, is a unique situation where a private company is literally standing in the shoes of the district
attorney. What about when a private company runs a prison?
I'm sorry?
What about when a private company runs a prison?
That's a different administrative function, if you will. We're talking
it's
about
different,
law enforcement.
But it's certainly at least as much of a state function.
I disagree. There could not be a more clear indication of state interest here when it comes to law enforcement. This is bad check diversion. This is the enforcement of California Penal Code Section 476A. That is a crime all across the state. All of the district attorneys in the 48 jurisdictions are charged with the duty of enforcing that crime. The legislation, the legislature from California, the plenary source of power for the state, has said that bad check diversion is a tool that the prosecutorial community can use to enforce this crime. The appellant is working solely under the auspices of the district attorney in that discharge of those prosecutorial functions. It is a very, very intimate relationship between this appellant and the state and the state's interest in its law enforcement program.
And it's different from a state privatization of the prison system. How?
Well, I think the case I think you have in mind, there
I don't have any particular case in mind. I simply have
the operation. Yes, if I yes. I'll get to your question. The operation of a prison is something that I think private interests can do on their own. They can sign up for a contract and run a
really?
Prison.
Really? Don't you think that the these people have been sent to prison by state courts? How long they're there and what happens to them when they're there is not going to be governed by the state. I sure hope it is.
Well, that is certainly an activity that I think is closer to an administrative function than the pure operation of law enforcement. I mean, this is a very unusual situation. And this fourth factor, whether the entity can take property in its own name, is indicative here. There is no way this appellant can collect restitutionary funds independent of the prosecutor. They can't do anything in their own name in that regard. So this fourth factor weighs very heavily in favor of 11th Amendment immunity here. We're talking about restitutionary funds. By definition, that is the product of the criminal justice system, focused on rehabilitation and punishment, which is what we learned from Kelly v. Robinson. Those funds are only flowing to and fro through the district attorney's authority as the enforcer of the penal codes for the state. Independent of that, the appellant can do none of these functions. So again, that factor weighs heavily in favor of 11th Amendment immunity. The third factor, whether the entity may sue or be sued. Well, again, a private company clearly can sue and be sued, but that doesn't show us any insights on its relationship to the state. Let's look at whether it can be sue or be sued in the connection with bad check diversion. I mean,
you're making an assumption here that the Mitchell factors are even useful here, as opposed to the fact that they are useful, although this isn't really articulated in the cases because it's an unwritten assumption, that first you have an entity that looks something like a state entity or a governmental entity before you start even asking these questions.
Your Honor, the best response I can give you is that the California legislature has stated, promulgated in 1001.60 of the Penal Code, that the district attorney can operate these diversion programs under his or her own roof, within their own office, or the statute allows that district attorney to hire a private company
exactly.
under contract. Very unusual situation for a pure law enforcement.
It's not function. Unusual in this day and age. That's the problem. And that's the point that Judge Posner, for example, was making in the Seventh Circuit case. It's very not unusual. In fact, the delegation of governmental functions to private entities is pretty usual. And the question is whether you get the best of both worlds by doing that.
What's unusual here is that this function is a purely a law enforcement function. It is the
Well, that's not so obvious either, case. Frankly. I mean, because you're in fact, you are accepting checks directly from private entities that have an interest in collection, and that you are largely operating as a collection agency.
Your Honor, I know those are the allegations, and someday they may be able to prove that. Certainly, we hope that that will be in the state court system, the tribunals of the state of California, where I do think these matters should be sorted out. Because when I get to the first factor, and perhaps I better jump there quickly, these restitutionary funds are the subject of this federal action, all right? They are seeking recovery of all of these funds that have flowed through this diversion program. The lion's share of those funds are restitutionary in nature. As a matter of law, they were collected by the state through this mechanism.
But in fact, as I understand it, you end up taking a big chunk of the money that would otherwise go directly to the retailers.
I will be happy to engage you on the facts, Your Honor. I will say that I do not think the merits of what happens is where they should not be the subject of
this. I understand that, but you're the one who's just brought them in.
Well, I will respond in this fashion. The appellant is paid by putting on the educational class. That is the way it derives its revenue.
Don't you also get a proportion of the recovered funds?
Only the processing fee. A portion of the processing fee, the $35 fee that is called out for in the statute.
So if, for example, there's a $10 check that you're recovering, then what? What does the and you get $45. You get, say you get $30. What happens to that money?
First of all, I want to be sure that we're clear that the money was collected, was recovered from the participant in the diversion program. They volunteered to participate. Those funds are collected in the name of the state. They're restitutionary funds. Now, the processing fee is related to the diversion turning the wheels, which our client is responsible for as authorized by the legislature. There is a $10 fee that is a return bank charge that the statute also allows for. It's an actual return bank fee up to $10, to be specific. Those funds go to the victims of the bad check crime. The processing fee is split or shared. It's not split. It's shared between the district attorney's jurisdiction, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, and the appellant on a continuous basis. That processing fee is shared on a continuous basis. The money flows in. It is held in a fiduciary account by the appellant. And then at the end of each month, the money flows
out.
So if the
person who wrote the bad check pays less than the total amount of the processing fee and the amount he owes, does all of the amount that he owes first go back to the bank? No.
Go back to the bank? Well, there's the face amount of the check. Regardless
right.
of how much it is,
right.
the $35 processing fee is called out for by the law, as well as the bank charge up to $10. The bank charge up to
$10. But the face charge, so the face amount of the check may not go back to the bank. If there's
correct.
If there's not enough to pay the processing fee first.
I want to be sure I'm understanding your question. The restitutionary funds is the face amount of the check. That's the way that's what I mean to say. The processing fee, the $35 I've described, the contract provides how that is shared. The bank fee up to $10.
All right, but you haven't answered my question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If the amount of money that the victim, putative defendant pays, is not enough to cover the processing fee and the face amount of the check. It's the face amount of the check, but it would be allowed enough to pay the face amount of the check first, itself. Does the face amount of the check get paid as restitution in total?
I'm going to be frank, Your Honor. I don't know that.
Well, the answer seems to be no, as far as I can tell.
Oh, no. I just don't know. I have no idea if there's a practice and I'm not trying to dodge you here. I really don't know in that particular circumstances how they would divide the money.
Okay.
But I want to come back to the point.
Is there anything in the record of what tells?
Yeah, I'm perhaps not in this particular hypothetical because it would be the subject of the contract. But the contract does make it very clear how the funds are collected, the character of the funds that are collected, and then how the funds are distributed by the state. Okay, that's the point. The character of these.
Now, is that all by statute or by regulation or what?
Well, the in this case, the legislation provides for the bad check diversion, the architecture itself. The district attorney then, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, as the prosecuting authority in their jurisdiction, they enter into the contract, which is also part of the record. In this case, it's just the one jurisdiction. But each district attorney throughout the state enters into its own contractual rights and duties with the appellant. And these are largely designed and tied to the statutory scheme. The contract says that the duties of the appellant are to assist in enforcing law and enforcing restitutionary orders and collecting the money in the way we've
described.
Okay, you've
well exceeded your time. Thank you very much. We'll give you a little time for rebuttal. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Deepak Gupta. I represent the plaintiffs. I believe two broad areas of inquiry emerged from Mr. Jenkins' argument. One is the application of the Mitchell factors on the facts of this case, and the other is the question of the propriety of applying Mitchell at all to private corporations. I'd like to start with the Mitchell factors and their application in the case, but if the Court feels it would be more useful to address those broader questions and jump ahead to them, I'd be happy.
I actually do.
Okay.
Because I said, it seems to me there's an unarticulated assumption in the cases that are when you're asking the question of whether it's whether various entities are of the arm of the state, those entities have certain characteristics that this one just lacks, to even ask the question about. I mean, that is that there are cases in which there is something state or government alike about the entity.
Right. I think the closest that anyone has come to maybe discussing this, and I think you mentioned this, is Judge Posner's opinion in the Tackle case. And what he said, he was dealing with a much more difficult question, I think, in that case than we are here. But what he said was, it would be nice if the entity's organic statute stated that it's a private entity rather than an arm of the state. That would resolve the issue. And I think what Judge Posner was getting at it is, if you had a statute that said this is a private entity in the view of the state, that would resolve the issue. Because the question is, where do you locate the entity on the public-private spectrum? And the unstated assumption in all of these cases is that that's what the arm of the state inquiry is intended.
Well, sometimes that's the inquiry, and sometimes it's, is it the arm of the state or the arm of something else?
That's right. The state versus local question.
Right.
I think probably that's the more common question. But there are a few cases in the vein of Tackle, and we've cited a few of them. There's the Tenth Circuit case about the privatized university laboratory. There's a First Circuit case about a public hospital corporation that has characteristics of a private corporation. But I think the unstated assumption in all of these cases is that you're trying to figure out where on the public-private spectrum the entity is. And And because privatization sometimes occurs in different ways, and the government isn't clear about what kind of entity it's created, you can have difficult questions in the middle of that spectrum. But this is a case that's on one far end of that spectrum, and I don't think there's any dispute about that here. The California statute that authorizes the creation of this program authorizes the delegation of it to a private corporation. And there's no dispute that this is a private corporation that's independent of the state. And I think it just so happens that no case has come up that's quite this clearly on one side of the spectrum. Probably the clearest such case is the Barron case in the Fifth Circuit. And what the Fifth Circuit did there was to apply its own version. Each of the circuits has a different multi-factor test, but to apply its own version of that test to the corporation. And it came very close, I think, to acknowledging that the test, it's almost absurd to try to apply some of these factors to a for-profit corporation. The first factor, I believe, in the Fifth Circuit's analysis is an inquiry into state law. And what the court said there was, we find nothing in the state constitution or codes or case law to suggest that this is anything other than a private corporation.
Does it make any difference that this is a corporation as opposed to a private entity? I can't see why, but for some reason the issue seems to be couched in terms of private corporations as opposed to private entities more generally. It wouldn't make any difference if it was just a person or if it were a nonprofit an association or an incorporated association or anything. Right? It's private. It's not the corporation has nothing to do with it, right?
That's right. I mean, I think that a private for-profit corporation, a traditional private for-profit corporation, is sort of a paradigmatic example of a truly private entity that's just not the state. I think you could have nonprofit organizations that maybe are performing some functions in concert with the state. The Brotherton case in the Sixth Circuit.
I have one question, which is the only set of cases that seems to me to be at all difficult here are the Medicare cases. So how do you account for those in terms of your theory?
Well, most of those cases are about federal sovereign immunity.
What difference does that make?
It's a completely different animal.
I mean, why?
Federal sovereign immunity, for one thing, it doesn't have the same kind of federalism concerns that animate it. It's not rooted in this.
So it's broader? I mean, you're suggesting it's broader. If that area, it would be narrow and not broader.
Federal sovereign immunity is certainly much narrower, and it's also because of the Administrative Procedure Act and other statutes, it's almost a shorthand.
But the Medicare, as I understand the Medicare situation, the statute or the regs, I'm not sure which, say that that the federal government is going to indemnify the private administrators and that the federal government is always the real party in interest. And I guess what I'm wondering is whether those cases are really constitutional cases at all or sovereign immunity cases at all, or whether they're just statutory cases in essence, perhaps, using the language of immunity, but in fact all they're doing is enforcing the statute.
I think that's right. I think that's certainly one way to read those cases. I think it is also important to recognize, though, that it's very different when you're talking about federal sovereign immunity as to state sovereign immunity. And the case law does not simply import findings of immunity in the federal sovereign immunity context.
But on what possible theory would whatever differences there are lead to the conclusion that federal contractors are more likely to have sovereign immunity than state contractors in general?
Well, I think, I don't know. This is not something that the Supreme Court has talked about, and it's hard to know where you get guidance from. The origins of state sovereign immunity itself are somewhat mysterious. But the notion is that state sovereign immunity derives from a kind of pre-ratification sovereignty. And I suppose you could say that maybe it works the other way around. If something is subject to federal sovereign immunity, then it's definitely going to be subject to state sovereign immunity. That's, I think that's what the 11th Circuit had in mind in the Shands case when it did import these cases that you're discussing into the state sovereign immunity context.
I just have a very hard time seeing why the federal state, it's a set of words, but it doesn't seem to me to have any content about why the federal sovereign immunity distinction or has any difference with regard to the how we're going to treat private entities as either having or not having immunity. So I understand that the statutory scheme, the Medicare scheme, is different and could account for the results, but I don't know if it accounts for the reasoning.
Yeah, it may be that there's a subset of cases in which when the government by statute makes the obligation at issue an obligation of the state, that there might be an immunity in that situation. I don't think this Court certainly doesn't have to wrestle with that question to decide this case. And
well, we sort of do, because if we're going to strike out outside the Mitchell factors and say that you know, we're just in a different world here because this is a purely private corporation and sovereign immunity just doesn't apply to it, then we have to be able to account for that set of cases.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you could say that absent some unusual set of circumstances in which the obligation is really the obligation of the state, the Mitchell factors don't apply. I think that would be a sensible rule, and it would be one that wouldn't put this Court in conflict with the 11th Circuit's decision in Shands.
Mr. Gupta, let me ask you to comment on something a little bit different. Judge Ware seems to have depended quite heavily on his conclusion that in this instance the DA was acting more in the capacity as a local official. You seem to shy away from that in your brief and don't depend on that hardly at all. Is that because you don't put too much stock in it?
Oh, no, not at all, Your Honor. I think Judge Ware was absolutely correct in that holding. And we do certainly defend that aspect of his reasoning in our brief. It's just one of five factors, but it's the factor that we discussed, I think, the most at length in our brief. And that's the central government function factor. And
no,
central.
I think Judge Tsushima is asking you something
else. Well, that's different, yeah.
Yeah, that's an entirely different theory, as I understand it, which is that this is really, if it is an arm of some governmental entity, it's of the county and not of the state. And that's the basis that Judge Ware decided the case. And the question
yes,
is, do you embrace that theory as well?
Yes, and I don't think that they're different inquiries, because the central government function factor under the Mitchell test, the question is whether central means state as opposed to local. And so if you know, the Strite case is an example of that. There are several cases in which the question is this really a state or a local program? And the entity is claiming to be an arm of the state. And so that's how you would analyze that. And so we do think that Judge Ware was correct. And Judge Ware said this. He said that the central government function factor pointed away from immunity because the district attorney was operating a local program here, not a state program. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll give you like 1 minute because you were already 7 minutes over your time when we stopped. Thank you.
I want to pick up with the Medicare cases, Your Honor. The Anderson case was decided here in the Ninth Circuit, and the defendant was Occidental Life Insurance Company. Again, I'm sure they're a private company, private corporation, and in that case, the Ninth Circuit found that sovereign immunity protected the
Is that case in your brief?
Excuse me?
Is that case in your brief?
It is not, Your Honor. I found that since.
Did you send us a 28-J letter on it?
No, Your Honor. I haven't. Can I cite it?
That makes it very hard for us to understand what you're talking about.
Okay, well.
And will you please leave the citation with the clerk?
I will do that, Your Honor. Forgive me. I want to come back to the arm of the state analysis. It would seem to me that whether the term central government function is not a commentary on whether it's the state or the local authority. I think that the commentary there is it's law enforcement. The central government function here is law enforcement, which is a paramount interest reserved to the state, of course. The first factor in Mitchell, and in case the briefing is unclear, Your Honor, we embrace the Mitchell test. It's a dynamic test. It served the circuit well. We're not running from Mitchell at all. In fact, the first factor, whether the money judgment would be satisfied out of state funds, we think is a complete factor in favor of 11th Amendment security here, because it's important. The Pennhurst case taught us that we have to look at the effect of the relief sought. We have to play it out a bit to determine whether the money judgment would be satisfied out of state funds. And if the court would indulge me, I have some
sites. I thought the contract here makes quite plain that it wouldn't be.
I'm sorry?
I thought the contract here makes quite plain that it wouldn't be.
Wouldn't
that it? No, would not be satisfied out of state funds, that the state is not going to indemnify you for any liability. Rather, it runs in the other direction.
I want to suggest there's a bigger picture here, Your Honor. I think the contractual risk shifting of indemnity is not the proper focus here. I believe there's some authority of that in the Regents case and the U.S. ex rel Ali case.
They're not both shifting. It's if somebody sues you for something you did, the state's not going to pay for it.
Before the contract was struck, that's what I meant about risk shifting, indemnity between the parties. That doesn't bear on the relationship to the state.
I'm not talking about indemnity now.
They're
suing you because they say you did X and Y. And it is plain from the contract that the state is not going to, unlike the Medicare cases, that the state is not going to pay any liability that you incur on that behalf.
I think that these restitutionary funds that have flowed through this bad check diversion program for 10 years are at stake here. They are, by definition, the character of those funds are state obligations, obligations to the state when they were paid into the program, and obligations of the state when they were returned to the victims. That's the state's function. The appellant cannot perform that function.
I mean, that's mighty peculiar for another reason, which is that the state has made no determination with regard to any of these funds that there was even probable cause to think that.
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, it's very difficult to answer a question if you're interrupted. The state has made no distinction, has made no determination with regard to any one of these checks that there is probable cause to believe that there was, in fact, any violation of state law. Is that correct?
That is not correct, Your Honor. And again, these are the underlying facts that will be the subject of
all right,
proof.
That's the allegation.
I can respond to it if you like.
So you're telling me that before you undertake to interact with somebody who wrote a bad check, there's first a DA determination as to whether or not there's probable cause to believe there was a legal violation.
Yes. I'm familiar with the
district of attorney makes individualized determinations separately.
No. No, Your Honor. But that's the whole point of diversion. I mean, the society benefits from the efficiency.
That's not, for example, the way traffic tickets work. I mean, first you have a determination by the police that there's a probable cause to think you committed a traffic violation. Then they write you a letter and say if you wanted to deal with a private company and go to traffic school. But first there's a determination that there was, in fact, probable cause to think that you committed a crime.
Bad check crime is different than the moving violation you described. I do think that this is a mere allegation, and I don't want to get into the defense that will occur in the lower courts, and perhaps in state court. But
you agree that there is no individualized determination by the district attorney of probable cause?
With respect to the checks that are submitted into diversion, that is the case.
Right.
But there is a mechanism, and again, sovereign immunity is not a qualified concept. I mean, it turns on the relationship between the state and the appellant. It really has nothing to do
with... That has something to do with the relationship between the state and the appellant, because it isn't the state that is making any determination, and you're not really either. Although you're representing that you are, you're simply taking the checks that you get and acting on them without doing any investigation, as far as I can tell.
The appellant is doing nothing that the district attorney doesn't authorize.
I understand that. That's
okay.
A different question.
These
All right,
funds,
anyway, you're out of time.
One last point, Your Honor. It's important that...
Did you hear her say you're out of time?
Oh, forgive me, Your Honor. I'm done.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.